Από πού ερχόσασταν και πού πηγαίνατε?
Από Λονδίνο ήμουν για Αθήνα.
Τέλος, καλό, όλα καλά.
Welcome to a new episode of Epirus Falls, all about the environment. Today, we're traveling to the village of Kalahori to speak with a representative from the action group Epirus Against Oil and Gas. Stavros Sotos has become a representative for his local community, challenging such proposals, whilst also coming up with some pretty innovative ideas to bring life back to his village. Welcome to a new episode of Epirus Falls, and I'm here with Stavros Sotos, and we're here in the beautiful village of Kalahori. Thank you for joining us today, Stavros.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for visiting us. It's amazing giving us the opportunity, to show our struggle against several environmental issues, but also to support our project to revive Kalahori, my village.
That's it. We're here to talk about the environment today, and we're going to get on to that. But firstly, tell us about this village that we're in. What makes Kalahori special for you?
It's a personal issue. I grew up here. It's my grandparents' place. I'm deeply rooted to the culture of the village. I was strongly connected to my grandmother, and that gave me a sense of responsibility to not let this place die forever.
Talk to me about the history of this village.
Well, a small community of people in a proximity of 3 to 5 kilometers around Kurenda Mountains. At least for the last 400 to 500 years, the history of these people are people that they lived through the Byzantine Empire, Ottoman Empire, and then modern Greek state. So they would be the cultivators of the land, but not fully the owners of it for centuries. They had good production of vegetables, grains, livestock, wood, and water. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, at least the withdrawal from our region in 1913, the people from the village had a nice idea that managed to make reality in 1920s to buy or retake back their land from the Greek state and the neighboring church. So they bought all the land, and it became a communal land. Back then, in the 20s, we had a big internal and external wave of migration to the big cities and abroad. The uprising of fascism all around Europe and here as well. So our ancestors really struggled to survive through this period. Soon after, we had the invasion from Italian fascist regime, and after the Nazi Germans. 1946 to 49, we had a civil war, super intense, in our village, involving many parts of the region. All the people were, in a way, involved and affected.
So this village got hit time and time again.
Oh, yeah. And then we had one other big wave of migration, mostly to Australia in the 60s, and then late 60s and 70s. The people that remained back moved to Athens or Yanina. So, yeah.
But it survived.
Not sure it survived. We will try to make it survive. It's important to point out here that there is no child living in the village anymore. So if you don't have kids living here, you almost lost the chain that make this village survive.
The village itself is set around 30 minutes away from the city of Yanina.
Yeah, it's not that far. The proximity is really helpful for us. And the road is quite good with not much of traffic.
And we're not at such a high altitude here.
Not really. It's 350. We have a nice breeze from Adriatic and the Ionian Pelago. So we don't really have that harsh winters, let's say. It's quite nice.
But you didn't grow up in this village. I mean, you came here on holiday, I imagine, several times a year. But where did you grow up?
No, I did grow up here, actually. That's my place.
You were born and raised here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. I grew up here. I wasn't coming and going. I was the one with my siblings and a few kids that were staying back when the other kids would go to Athens or abroad or to Ioannina. But I'm an actual child of this village.
What did your parents do work-wise in order to keep them here in the village?
My mother had to travel every day to the city because he was a military nurse. My father would take care of the sheep and goats and the fields, but also would work in the city. So he would take care of, let's say, the exports of feta around the globe, mostly that.
But that's the best. You have a father who knew about the land. And like me, you had a mother who worked as a nurse. I grew up with a mum who was a nurse. You can't get away with being sick.
Not really. And
you can't get those days off school, can you?
No, you could. On top of that, they had a super caring grandmother. So we had the actual... and we have an airplane passing.
Military jets.
Yeah.
These things only seem to happen when we start recording. Sounds like your grandmother had a huge impact on you.
Indeed. She had these teachings from her ancestors that they would be able to pass to her only through oral teachings. No books could describe the way that they would forage oregano, or they would smash the charcoal to make an antidote for a diarrhea, for example, or how to take care of the animals, how to behave within a community. I'm the third child myself, so I was privileged to be the one next to my grandmother, not my father and mother as much as my bigger brothers. So, yeah, I'm really connected to her.
So you were able to be educated at the time in this village too? The school was functioning?
Yeah, not in Kalahori, but in the neighboring village of Utsaras for primary school. Actually, I was the first child of the kindergarten. And then, there was a functional school where 20 to 25 kids. And then secondary school to another village, high school to the city. I feel that I was able to receive education no matter the distance from the big city or Athens, and especially educate myself on topics of such as environment or culture. Like, we had our cultural space here all the time. We had information, including games, coming from Athens with the other kids during summer holidays. So we're constantly up to date, let's say, in everything happening.
So tell me what happened after that for yourself. Where did you go once school was up?
I was a rower in the city of Ioannina. So I was coming and going in the city and here. My grandmother was still alive, so I was keep coming and going for her and for me as well. And then I got into university and I moved to Crete for 5 years at least.
And what did you go and study?
History and archaeology.
Okay, so what was that like to finally leave Epirus and go to the other end of Greece?
Exciting. A new world, a new space for me to grow and thrive, to be able to socialize in the way I want to. Educate myself. It was a period that I could answer to many questions I had in my mind about my grandmother's past, about civil war, about Nazi and fascist Italians' occupation in the village. And most of these topics, I wouldn't reach them through school history. So university was really a good place to decode all these stories.
What were your feelings like for Epirus once you finished your time in Crete?
It was a period of in my life that I didn't know what I want to do. And I was desperate to see more from the world. I had to do my military shift. I did that in Cyprus. I faced 2 years of unemployment, mostly in the village. It was a very nice period of my life, I would say, even though I was struggling even, you know, to buy coffee. It was during the financial crisis. Then I tried to do many things. Soon after 2016, the first refugee camp opened in the city. So a lady I knew from another activistic group reached out to me to go and do something to support the first newcomers in the city. So I went there and I set up a Greek school for teenagers and young people.
Okay, and is that what you continue to do until today, at least part-time?
I do it full-time till now. Sometimes I choose to have long breaks from one assignment to another. I work for an agency dealing with migration and refugees in general. I'm specialized in child protection, gender-based violence, sometimes anti-trafficking. So now I'm in Malta, but before that I was here for 7 months and I was able to work.
So we're lucky to find you back here in Epirus.
Exactly. It was a very nice timing. I returned just for 1 week to work with friends and my family for the renovation of the village cafe. So yeah.
So this area that we're in now, half an hour away from the city of Yanina, has a long-standing threat from companies hoping to extract oil and gas. And from what I've read and the different pieces of the puzzle I've been putting together, Greece has very much been earmarked to become an energy hub.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're there already in the sense of green energy deals. Generally, we see our land, our landmarks in nature, such as mountains and plains, get destroyed from mass wind turbines or solar panels. But here we also face, as you mentioned, a much bigger threat, oil and gas drill. Unfortunately, it's a reality that we have to deal with. To me, these projects only benefit big petroleum and construction companies. In reality, we don't get anything back, neither us or the environment. Our river, like we are part of Kalamazoo Valley, has suffered from industrial pollution. All the industrial pollution from Ioannina and the hospital's pollution comes through a channel directly to Kalamazoo River. And that reduced the species of the river, the fish species of the river, just to 4. And also contaminated with Escherichia coli, heavy metals, and many more. So we're not able to eat the fish, we are not able to swim, and not even to water, you know, our plants, our production. 2 days ago, a new fine was given to the Ioannina City Public Water Authority, 10,000 euros per day, because of the systematic pollution of the river. They have the biological treatment of water, which is not function. So we have to pay again more for the maintenance of the lifestyle in urban places. It's unfair, it's not efficient, and it's not effective either. So if we want really to help our environment, we should stop destroying the only actual real green environments, the only sustainable environments we have. And last year, I learned from the media that they are going to drill here in the top of our mountains. Kurenta Mountains. We shared these three or four villages. I knew that I have to engage myself more. And I knew that the movement needed the community of these areas to fight more than any other. It was our primary responsibility, let's say, to do something about it.
Why do you think this particular part of Epirus has been targeted?
We are not a touristic area. We don't have the beautiful and rich architecture of Zagori or Tzoumerka. And that created, let's say, a situation, a very bad situation, where politicians and also big industries thought it's a good opportunity to install and implement their projects here.
However, from what I've read in the past, there is a ripple effect that will happen. If they begin the drilling here, the whole ecosystem will be affected and potentially the whole of Epirus.
We know that the company, even in their website, but also from the legal documents, we see that Ioannina Field belongs to them, and Ioannina Field starts from Zagori and ends up in the coastal parts of Epirus. And there is no recording in human history that one company drills only one spot. They have 100 square kilometers, or maybe more, maybe my calculation is really wrong, but they actually have license to drill wherever they want in Epirus. They will not stop here if they find something. And we already know that if they decide to go, and if we're not able to stop them, they're going to drill everywhere around us.
And this is happening despite much of Epirus now being classed as a World Heritage Site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's an irony in that.
There's huge irony that they give much focus on the UNESCO sites of Zagori, but here we are people from another world, you know. It's like the poor relatives within the same region.
You think the government would be happy if actually the population of these villages in the near future was zero?
I'm pretty sure about it. They're already super happy seeing other villages being completely abandoned. And I don't see any actual intention from their side to change the situation. And we are struggling, and we don't have much of friendly, let's say, policies to support our project. So yeah, they would be pretty happy if everything would tend to us here.
We have to find solutions across the world for the energy crisis. Of course, they're going to earmark places to become energy hubs. What right do we have to pick and choose where they build these?
First of all, we have the right to choose what the solution is, and not just where they will implement what they decided in big stock markets. We are benefiting from oil and gas production, as you mentioned, and electricity from charcoal and many more, let's say, other sources. That doesn't mean that we will have to solve the problem by producing more or by creating alternatives that they're not really beneficial for the nature and for the people living in nature, but also in urban places. I think that in most of the problems, we have to look a bit internal to ourselves as part of the problem and part of the solution. If we start consuming less energy, we will definitely create a huge positive impact for the natural environment we live in, but also in the diplomatic scene. And I'm not really seeing anyone to create such a solution in, let's say, governmental level, not just in Greece, but all around the world. I created the Epirus Against Oil and Gas Instagram page. Epirus Against Oil and Gas is an umbrella term to describe the different groups and independent activists that we fight against oil and gas in Epirus region.
So this village is now facing these huge threats from companies that are wishing to extract oil and gas. That's a hell of a lot for you and anyone else involved in these protests to take on.
Sometimes it's too much, but if you want to fight for something and you have a reason, you have just to deal with it. And we will deal with it. We are dealing with it. We will either abandon completely our motherland and go and live in a big city or in another village, or we will try to protect it. And I prefer staying here and protecting it. And nobody wants to run away from this village.
Let's forget the current politics. Let's go into a happy space.
Yes, thank you. Well, I believe that we can turn this paradise into a sustainable living space for more people. These villages, they have the ability to host more people. There are abandoned houses that they can be renovated. And now we have the knowledge, we have the scientific knowledge and experience in order to create a better future. We don't have to struggle anymore in the way that we would struggle in the past without having the good tools to build our houses, or treat the water, cut the firewood, or travel from one place to another. So my vision is a society in Epirus, a group of many different small or in bigger villages that they communicate, exchange culture. They have their own academic institutions. They also focus in science. They are open to other cultures and they communicate their ideas. They produce their own foods and they share the excess organic food to the cities. In the same way, we, let's say, make cities also sustainable because fewer people would live there. And it's not just my vision. There are many people around Greece and around the world that they're trying to create something like that for centuries.
And that's why you formed a group called Ecotopia. And you are raising funds to fix this village's fortunes.
Exactly.
Tell us a bit about Ecotopia.
So Ecotopia is a new project. It's a social cooperative enterprise. We're six people from the village. We're mostly young people that we love being here. We love being in our village. We want to create the conditions so we can resettle back or live here in with good conditions, let's say, in a situation that we feel alive, that we feel creative, that we feel healthy, less stressed, and that we also socialize with people that they want to see such an example. I also know that there is a huge challenge, and for me this is mostly socialization, the ability to be able to socialize and to not lose what you have in the city. And I mean, being honest here, we all want to party, we all want to have fun, we all want to, have an easy way of living. So we're trying, by using social media and science, to bring this here so we don't have to travel that often or living in the big cities.
So your vision is for this to be a functioning village again and quite a self-sufficient economy here.
Yeah, that's the goal. I think we have already the ancestral knowledge on how to be sufficient. The glue of the project is the understanding that we do this as a cooperative. Different people with different perspectives on how to work on specific things, a different amount of time that we can sacrifice voluntarily to make our goal a reality. We're really excited about it. We couldn't expect that we will have that much of support in such a short period of time. And now we also feel the responsibility to implement what we promise to the people that support our crowdfunding campaign. really, actually, thank you from your support, the financial and also the podcast and the actual empowerment by having you and your team here. It's really touching, you know. I felt so blessed having a person not just giving such a big amount of money for our support, but the words you said, like, I felt really touched, and I was ready to have tears running down, because I realized that behind this screen there is a person that really got what I have in my mind, what is my vision and my intentions about a better future. So I don't even have words to describe how blessed I felt and how thankful.
It's nothing. I'm just happy to have the opportunity to come here today and actually see what you have planned and actually see some of the works in progress.
Yes, exactly.
I see a painter outside and you're scraping all the old plaster off the Café Neon. And that's your first target.
Yes.
The community center, the cafe. That's going to be open when?
Our base is going to be open on the 21st of December. So we're going to have a presentation of Ecotopia Cooperative and also the opening of the Café Neo with a nice party. And community gatherings and
Tsipouro.
Tsipouro, yes. We can have some after the interview.
And then tell me about the other steps. I know that your current financial target is 10,000 euros. Mm-hmm. What will raising that amount of money help you achieve?
Our goal is 10,000 euros to cover a variety of startup needs. It's not just targeting in specific projects such as Café Neo, but we already know that with the 2K, we are opening the Café Neo within a month and a half. So this is a goal achieved already. We have urgent needs covering administrative, legal, and other similar costs of 1,000 euros. We have 3,500 euros budget estimation in order to set up the organic gardens. Most of the money would go for fencing, actually, creating a kiosk, a greenhouse. Then we need 2,000 euros, let's say, start the renovation of the first house just for the architectural licenses and research. And what I'm missing, we also need a small amount of money just to get some tools and start working in the trails around the village, so we're able to have nice paths so people can hike around.
So, currently living most of the time in Malta, working in Malta. You're 35 now.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a bit about how you envisage your own future.
I hope and I wish that by mid-2025 I will be able to resettle back here to work with my partners in the cafe cooperative and also in the communal and organic gardens. By next year, I want this project to give me the opportunity to be able to travel abroad and meeting people from other communities doing similar projects. So, yeah, that's my goal. In 1 year, I want to be here, settle here, be able to travel, share knowledge, exchange ideas, being able to teach what I learned from my grandmother, but also what I learned while working in the humanitarian environment. Hosting my colleagues from the humanitarian environment in such a beautiful place and peaceful environment that they're in need of. And yeah, more or less.
That's amazing.
I wouldn't say that I'm prepared, but I want to do my best to achieve, let's say, something now to prevent the destruction. If we manage to show to people that we're not just saying no, but we create a new model that is fair for all, good for the environment, and also envisions something better for the world and ourselves, I think we will be able to push harder back this kind of terrible projects.
Do you believe we can stop the big machine?
Yes, I'm pretty sure we can. And we will. I think most of the people in Greece, they are against oil and gas drills because they already see the impact of the green projects. So if you see green projects that destroys your village or your habitat environment, you can easily assume what will happen if you're drilling for oil and gas. I don't believe that this government will be there forever as well. I also think that we have more ways to fight against that, not just convincing government. We live in a so-called democracy, and there should be a mechanism to prevent such an injustice. So we are also using, as a coalition of associations and activists, our rights to block this kind of projects. And we also collaborate from people from around the world, and we are able to talk with other people from our tiny villages and the big cities in the same language in real time through social media and internet. And it's easy to communicate nowadays our ideas and to find common solutions, common ground, so we can build on that.
Stavros, this has been another great conversation.
Thank you.
And you're bringing life back to your village, and that is such a positive form of protest.
Hopefully. Thank you so much. It was lovely discussing with you. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak up about the actual problems. Usually people don't really want to listen to the negative part of it. They don't want to have a downside in their podcast or in their documentary, or but it's good, really good. We had this chance, and thank you so much.